work of Roach, Lincoln, and other jazz artists in the late 50s. First was going to see Max Roach and Abby Lincoln present their Freedom Now suite at the National Convention of the NAACP. I had been raised on jazz and had done my homework with Eddie Collier while listening to John Coltrane's Giant Steps. But this was the first time I had heard message music so direct for my generation. The Freedom Now suite immediately raised my political, cultural consciousness. Noted musicologist Dr. F. Ricky Vincent has credited Roach and Lincoln as being among the forerunners of the funk movement in jazz and later black popular music, the funk being the realness, earthiness, and Africanity that fueled dozens of groups from James Brown to Parliament Funkadelic and beyond. Although jazz is a relatively small slice of record or CD sales these days, 2% according to the Recording Industry Association of America for 2006, it's more than classical, but less than children's music for the same period. It has had a powerful and outsized impact on music, politics, and culture. Abby Lincoln, with her moving and memorable contralto, certainly played a leading role in that march, and she will be remembered. Lincoln was 80. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Ooh. Uhuru, you're listening to Uhuru Radio. This is Diasporic Music. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, and we are welcoming you to Remember Black August Part 2. Also, this is a tribute to Aminata Museka, a.k.a. Abby Lincoln, and we're going to have a very, very exciting show for you today. We're going to be interviewing three young men about Black August in about a half an hour. We're also going to be playing some more music at 3 o'clock and at 3:30. We're going to be speaking with Kilu Inyasha, who is out of the Bay Area, living in the Bay Area, and she's going to be talking about giving us some personal reflections on George Jackson. She knew George Jackson personally. And first of all, I'd like to begin the show by thanking Omali Ishatella, the chair of the African People's Socialist Party and the African Socialist International, for giving me this opportunity to participate on Uhuru Radio. And I would also like to thank my brother and my comrade, Archie Shep, who gave me the concept of diasporic music, playing music that was made in the West, but it's not of the West, and we wanted to, I guess we should say that we were playing the music of Aminata Museka, a.k.a. Abby Lincoln, and she did a piece called Triptych, Prayer, Protest, and Peace, and that was a very, very controversial piece. That came off an album called We Insist Freedom Now, Sweet,
an album that she recorded along with her then-husband, Max Roach. And that album came out in 1960, and it was banned by the South African government in 1964 because it was so powerful. There's a piece on there called Tears for Johannesburg and All Africa. Very powerful piece. So the South African government banned that. They also banned Randy Weston's Uhuru Africa, and that was Africa with a K. Abby, not Abby Lincoln, but Lena Horne had an album or a song out called Now. The South Africans banned that. And Abby and Max's Roach's music really influenced a lot of people, including people like Maxwell Stanford, who later became Muhammad Ahmed. He wrote a book called We Will Return in the Whirlwind, Black Radical Organizations, 1960 to 1975. And he went to see Max and Abby perform the Freedom Now Suite at an NAACP convention. And his, put it this way, his mind was blown. Well, let us continue with the music of Aminata Museka. And we're paying tribute to Aminata Museka in this first half an hour. This is Aminata Museka, and this is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. Alafia and Uhuru. This is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. We were listening to Garvey's Ghost by Aminata Museka. Most people know Aminata Museka by the name Abby Lincoln, and Abby Lincoln was an actress, and she first performed in a film called Girl Can't Help It, where she was with Jane Mansfield, and she likes to talk about the fact that she had to wear this, well, she actually wore Marilyn Monroe's dress. She went on to do a film called Nothing But a Man with Ivan Dixon, and did some films with Sidney Poitier. I think it was To Sir With Love. I might be wrong on that one, but she was with Mr. Poitier. She also played in Mo' Better Blues. She played Denzel Washington's mother in that particular film. So she was an actress as well, and she recorded, after she broke up with Max Roach, she recorded up into 2007. But she was also a part of a group called the Cultural Association for Women of African Heritage, and this was a political cultural group out of New York City, and it featured a woman by the name of Maya Angelou was a member of that group, and also a sister by the name of Rose LaGuy, who was born in Trinidad, and she lived in New York, I think. Rosa Guy is still in the land of the living, and Maya Angelou is definitely still in the land of the living. But when Patrice Lumumba was assassinated on January 17, 1961, I believe, Abby Lincoln, Rosa Guy, Maya Angelou, as well as Max Roach, went to the United Nations, and they caused quite a disturbance, and go back and do some YouTube work, and you can see that they might even have that demonstration on YouTube. But we're going to continue with the music of Abby Lincoln, Aminata Museka, and this is a piece she did, and it's called Africa, and she put some words to the John Coltrane song Africa, and this is Aminata Museka, and when we come back, we're going to be speaking with members of the Black August Organizing Committee from Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, California, and Oakland, California. And this is Uhuru Radio, and my name is Norman Otis Richmond.
On the
You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, and we were listening to the music of Aminata Museka, a.k.a. Abby Lincoln. She did a piece called Africa, which was a composition by John Coltrane and Abby Lincoln. Aminata put lyrics to it, and we're getting ready to talk to some gentlemen about Black August. But before we talk about Black August, I wanted to we received an email, or not an email, we received something from Skype. I'm a semi-Luddite, and I know there's a difference between Skype and email, but Naibinga was going to, Binga is going to read the email.
This email is from Femi, who says, Aminata Museka? Never heard of her. Educational music. Music as a tool, an instrument of education. This is why I dig you Uhuru people. Broad. You are broad.
And thank you, Femi. Femi's calling from the UK, or Skyping from the UK. I want to get into this, to our Black August, Remember Black August Part 2. We have on the line from the Black August Organizing Committee, Kumasi, coming out of Los Angeles, California. We also have Shaka Asinin, coming out of Oakland, and we have Najee Mujahid. He's in Washington, D.C., and he is with the Black August, I can't get it right now, Black August Planning Organization, and we wanted to begin with Najee because we understand that there's been a lot of great activities going on in Washington, D.C. So, Brother Najee, you can kick it off.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. And, you know, in D.C., we've been doing what we try to do every year and offer a whole month of programs designed to, you know, educate people, you know, on this rich history and the meanings of Black August and encourage them to get involved. You know, as we know, Black August developed as a means to, you know, reinvigorate and re-inspire the movement that was going on inside the prison. So we try to take that opportunity and do the same thing out here, you know, reinvigorate people and also, you know, pull those in who, you know, are unaware of a lot of the rich history that we have in, you know, resistance to struggle. You know, it's not taught in school. So, you know, a lot of the people who, you know, were able, who, you know, come out to, you know, our programs and events. You know, it's the first time they ever heard or saw anything like this before. And, you know, it gets hard at times, you know, trying to do stuff all month long. You know, most places, you know, that I'm aware of, they may consolidate everything into a weekend, like a Friday, Saturday, Sunday kind of thing. And, you know, we haven't gotten that habit, but, you know, I can see some of the practical, you know, wisdom of doing it like that. You know, but I think when you do it like that, it becomes, you know, more, you know, just a isolated event. You know, it's something that, you know, you're trying to pound into people's consciousness, you know, week in and week out, you know, through the month, and hopefully they'll take that with them, you know, for the rest of the year. So, you know, what we did this year, we didn't have all of the resources we had last year, so we had to scale some things down a bit. But we're working with a local business, Sankofa Vidyon Bookstore. We work with them every year. The proprietor is Haile Garim and his wife, Rikiana, who were the directors and producers of the film Sankofa that many of you have probably seen. And we've been working with them to do a film series. And this evening we're showing the film A Panther in Africa that features Pete O'Neill, who's been in exile since the 70s. You know, for a trumped up charge they tried to give him. And Mama Charlotte, his wife, is going to be coming in via video Skype and discussing with the group. We invited Stan Willis out earlier this month. You know, Stan Willis was one of the people who took the lead in drafting this report that's going to the UN that outlines some of the abuses and the reality of political prisoners, and I think we want to get a chance to talk about that later. Next week, we're taking our fourth annual pilgrimage to Richmond, Virginia. We got some comrades down there to do a tour and a history lesson on Gabriel Prosser and everything that was going on in Virginia and the revolt. One of the things we came to learn through doing this is how the majority of black people in the United States can trace their roots back to Virginia, Richmond in particular, because after the slave trade was outlawed, the transatlantic slave trade was outlawed, a breeding process began. And in Richmond, you know, it was like a primitive kind of eugenics program that they was running, so much so that people, you know, plantation owners would come from all over the country to go to Richmond because Richmond had the superior stock, for lack of a better term. We also were able to work with the UNIA and brought Bilal Sunni Ali in town this year, who did a discussion in a concert. Most of you know he came out of the Brinks conspiracy trial and defended by Chokwe Lumumba. Him and his wife were able to, you know, beat the charges, but Mutulu Shakur and others, as were his co-defendants, have been in prison since that time. And in previous years, we've been able to, you know, invite several different former political prisoners and just do different, you know, I said programs, discussions, workshops, and try to, you know, imbue people's consciousness with this, and we've seen the effects. You know, like, you know, people in D.C., you know, within the activist community, they have a sense of this, and they appreciate our work. So, you know, we're going to keep doing it, and hopefully, you know, keep this thing going.
Let me say that. I know you showed a film, Finally Got the News, about the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and also Bilal Sunni Ali. I think Imam Bilal Sunni Ali, he's a saxophonist. He played with Gil Scott-Heron. We played him the last show we did. We played him on. He wrote, I think, Western Sunrise and a bunch of great tunes with Gil. I saw him once in concert with Gil in Toronto.
What about it?
No, I said I saw Bilal play with Gil Scott-Heron. Yeah, with the first Midnight Band, Bilal Sunni Ali was a part of Gil Scott-Heron's Midnight Band.
That's right.
Yeah. But had you finished, or should I? Does anyone else want to chime in, or had you finished, my brother?
Yeah. I know we're short on time, so I'm trying to be as concise as possible. You know.
All right, you're listening to Uhuru Radio, and this is Diasporic Music, and who's going to chime in now? I'm sorry.
That was a good report. Okay, Shaka, you want to report on the Bay Area, on Oakland, California?
Well, right now, we're trying our best to get people involved in the legal process of opening up communication to these prisons and stuff. The California Department of Corrections, they have a prison union, a guards union. It's the most powerful union in California. The governor is scared of them. Everybody is, all the legislatures, everybody. And what they're doing now is flexing their muscles. They're putting these videos and documentaries and all this stuff on TV, spooking the public up about how terrifying prisoners are and how we can't release these people back into the community because they'll kill all of you and all this kind of stuff. These judges have ordered them to release 40,000 prisoners because of overcrowding, because their sentences are too long, and a number of reasons. So what they're doing now is they are isolating all of the ones they call the most politically deterrent, okay, the most, what we call the most revolutionary. But they call it revolutionary bullshit or revolutionary hype, okay? What they're doing in all of the different prisons, they're pulling everybody that relates to Black August, anybody that has anything to do with Black August, anybody that has anything to do with the name of George Jackson or any of that kind of, they take them, they isolate them, they put them in SHU programs. We understand the SHU programs, the Security Housing Unit programs, they're sensory deprivation. So right now, California is leading the way, is leading the charge with these sensory deprivation units. Okay, and Pelican Bay, which is way up on the Oregon border, it's totally isolated. It's like going to Outer Mongolia somewhere. If you want to visit your relative, it's a full day's trip just to get there. So they have these brothers up there, and they've isolated them into pods, what they call pods. And in each pod, they've stripped them down to cells. So there's 8 cells per pod, and one of those cells houses an African American. The rest is Mexican and white. So the racism issues, the psychological deprivation issue. You can have one book per cell. Your pictures, your letters, and all that stuff is taken periodically every so many weeks. Just like Bunchy's little brother, Fatih. Every couple weeks.
Al Prentice Bunchy Carter.
Al Prentice Bunchy Carter, his little brother, Fatih Carter, is in Pelican Bay. And every few weeks they go in his cell just for the psychological effect of doing it, and they take all of his property and throw it away. So all the letters that he's gotten in a few weeks, in that 3-week period, pictures, what have you, they take it and they throw it away. And
which is all he owns. In other words, he has nothing in that cell. He can't expect anything during the course of the day except meals and mail, and they take the mail.
That's it. That is the only thing that he can consider personal. Okay, the only thing other than himself. And he's stamped as a property of the state. So it's the psychological torture that's going on that has nothing to do with a prison sentence. It has nothing to do with the crime that you committed 20, 30, or 40 years ago, which is in the case of most of these brothers that are in Pelican Bay. They've been in there 30 and 40 years, okay, locked in these sensory deprivation unit. So we're trying to mobilize people out here to understand the need for that communication. We can't communicate with them anymore. We are considered gang members. We're considered instigators. And they come up with all of these different penitentiary rules to keep us from communicating with these brothers and sisters in these penitentiaries. And we're trying to get it takes the people out here on the street doing programs like the one that Kumasi and them did in L.A. last night, where you have this brother down there, and you know, they make a prison cell and have somebody in it actually describing the feeling of what's going on. People need to see that kind of stuff. So those are the things that we're trying to get people involved in, and that's the wave that needs to spread. So, you know, that's just that's just part of the need that goes along with, you know, the going to the UN and the Geneva Conference and talking to the Congressional Black Caucus and Congress and all of these different entities that deal with the legal aspects. The judges in California have already ruled that this stuff is cruel and unusual. But CDC, like I say, California Department of Corrections, is a powerful entity, and they just say, okay, we'll deal with the $50,000 fine or the $100,000 fine and forget you. We're going to keep doing business as usual. So that's the state of affairs in California.
You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond. I'm on the line with, we just heard from Shaka Afenin. We also heard from Naji out of Washington, D.C. Shaka's in Oakland, and Kumasi is going to make his contribution. Kumasi is with the Black August Organizing Committee, and he's based in the City of Angels, Los Angeles. How you doing?
Okay, man. That's fine, Norman. I think it was interesting that Shaka brought up the fact that the California Correctional Officers, peace officers union, the prison guard union, has spent a lot of money producing a lot of imagery through films that they can feed to the public to give the public an idea, their idea, of what a convict, what a prisoner is, and how vicious and how out of control these prisoners are, and why it is necessary to have excessive restraint and more than maximum security confines to keep them within and treat them the way they are treating them, and saying in essence to the public, you know, whatever we do to them, it's their fault because they're so out of line, so out of behavior. We had to remove them from society in the first place, and once they got in here, they acted such a fool. We had no choice but to use all of these extreme measures to just try to hold them in check, and we're not even capable of doing that. Okay, but what they have done is shown you a kind of prisoner and a kind of condition has nothing to do with what we're talking about, all right? They will not show you what they're doing to those prisoners who are fighting political battles and who are fighting legal battles to challenge and to eradicate the types of extreme, excessive, abusive measures that they have put in place, the kind of humanity, inhumanity, that they are practicing in these prisons that is not acceptable by any civilized nation. And this is why this stuff is going to the United Nations Human Rights Commission. And it's also going to the Geneva Convention. Their delegates are going to go there with facts, in other words, formal packets of information that tell you who, what, when, where, and why. For instance, they don't talk about the fact that they threw a prisoner in a tub of water so hot that it melted the skin off his bones in Pelican Bay. All right? They don't talk about the fact that the conditions in Pelican Bay are as the lead statement, the title of their own description of Pelican Bay in their own newsletter was a fate worse than death. That they treat you so inhumanely, that they drive you in cycles, in and out of sanity. One day you're sane, the next day you're insane. You know what I'm saying? That your behavior, the sensory deprivation, is. Had they done this in the 1940s and the world knew about it, they would have been in the Nuremberg trials along with the Nazis. This is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
Okay? And they do it with the compliance and the agreement of the courts. Because the courts always send back an answer to you whenever you file any kind of class action litigation. They say, we leave it to the discretion of the wardens to run their prisons the way they run their prisons. And their suggestion is that if we don't let them run the prisons, either the wardens are going to be in charge or the prisoners are going to be in charge. So we're going to take the lesser of two evils. We're going to let the warden be in charge. But the warden is in charge of a kind of behavior that is not acceptable anywhere on this planet. They treat these prisoners in this country far worse than they did the prisoners in Abu Ghraib, far worse than they do the prisoners. I mean, they were babysitting the prisoners over there in Guantanamo Bay. And when they bring them from Guantanamo Bay to these SHU programs and control units in this country, then you're going to find out them guys are going to beg to go back to Guantanamo. All right? And if they got any sense, they're going to rebel, even if it means dying in the rebellion. But nobody with any kind of dignity they're going to accept the things that they're doing. The reason why you got the kinds of prisoners and the kinds of prison activity in the prison that you see on these TV images, like the program Locker, is because they have removed the political prisoner who is active and fighting political battles, who is not only educated himself. Just for instance, you know how you saw the picture Hurricane about Hurricane Carter, and in that film you have an older, wiser brother who takes a younger brother under his arms and he starts to groom him and educate that brother's character and turn that brother around and make that brother somebody productive, so that no matter where he is, in prison or out of prison, he has got more control over himself, and now he is fit to be a unit, a link in a chain that is a productive chain that can produce some things that are desirable rather than undesirable. So now he can be an asset rather than a liability to himself, his race, his family, his community. Okay, that one individual that took that one individual under his arm is not one person. There are a whole group of people in all penitentiaries who take that responsibility. And if you remove them from the main line and put them in these control units, they can't put their hands on these younger brothers. They can't get a grip on them. They can't help them develop themselves individually and personally, can't help them develop the tools that they need to cope with the worst situations in life, so that if they do make it back to society, if they do make it back to this side of the wall, that they can be productive and they can be useful, not only to themselves, but to others that they come in contact with. Because once, it's like an each one teach one. Once you groom him that way, then he's going to reach down and help somebody else. We got a film of a brother that talks about how he was in a hole in San Quentin. And he was in this cell just talking wild and crazy, calling women all kind of crazy. Now, what he was doing was pimping and carrying on over the tier, loud. And all these other prisoners was listening to him, disrespect himself, disrespect black women. And so he said that the next day he heard these chains dragging along the floor. And he said, and this big old brother stopped in front of his cell and said, comrade, he said, was that you and your homeboy last night that was out on the tier pimping and playing and carrying on and talking all that stuff? And he said, yeah, that was us. He said, well, let me tell you something, man. He said, down here on this tier, we do not allow the white man to occupy the inside of the thighs of our black women. And he said, you can't be calling them all these names and stuff. And I suggest you park that Cadillac so you get it totaled out. And then he stole off. And he said, that was George Jackson. And he says, I'll never forget that. And he said, and I started hoorahing. I got to talking about, man, you see that big old piss cutter from so-and-so talking? He don't know. That old man don't know. I don't wear him out. And then he saw these kites going down the tier. These dudes were throwing strings with letters on the ends of them. And they was passing word from cell to cell. And he said, they were planning on killing him. But George Jackson told him, no, man, don't kill that brother. Man, he got a lot of potential, man. We just got to work with him, put our hands on him. That's all. And he said, because George Jackson spared his life, and he said he was talking all that old crazy stuff, he didn't know that these brothers down here was killers. And he said all George Jackson had to do was wave his hand. And he said, my head would have bounced down the tier like an NBA basketball. He said, but he spared me. And that, because he spared me, that taught me that when a young brother running up on me talking wild and crazy, he said, instead of me killing him like I know I could, he said, I'd give him a pass too. So that's what we mean by each one teach one. That's what we mean by living by example, man, and showing people, man, if we want people to respect us, we got to show respect for ourselves. And the prisoners that we're talking about, the political prisoner, he doesn't look, he doesn't dress, he doesn't walk, he doesn't talk like all these other prisoners. He does not compete in all this racketeering to see who's going to run the penitentiary for the warden by participating and controlling the rackets in the penitentiary, the prostitution, the homosexuality, the drug dealing, and all this kind of stuff. The political prisoner doesn't take part in those kind of activities. He doesn't horseplay, all right? He doesn't go around fussing and cussing and talking out the side of his neck and getting involved in all these little petty bickering arguments and little fights and all that kind of stuff. He carries himself in a very upright manner. He has a structured life, and he structures himself with the other people that's in the movement. And they take part in making sure that they have the skills to survive these circumstances, to cope with these circumstances. And they have to show other brothers that are in the penitentiary, man, who don't have no life, no light at the end of the tunnel. They're going to be in there for the next 40, 50 years. And the question is, how do I do these 50 years? What do I do with myself? So they show him. You got brothers right now reading about George Jackson and how he did 1,000 fingertip push-ups in the cell, how much he read, how his companions, when he was in the cell by himself, became some of the major figures and characters and leaders and scientists and great thinkers around the world. That as he read their books, he became friends with them. That became his only companionship, what these individuals that he took up and he read. Now they didn't put these televisions in these cells, and these guys don't read. They watch cartoons all day. So when you take us away from them and put us in these shoe programs and isolate us, then you now have set the stage for all these kids to grow up in these penitentiary without no direction, without any knowledge, without any knowledge of themselves or any sense of who they are or what the world is made up of and how they got to be where they are and how they're going to come up out of there or how they're going to sustain themselves if they have to stay.
All right, Kumasi, so now Kumasi, we only have about 5 minutes left, and I wanted to know what can people do, what would you like people to do? Who are outside and can do what can be done? Yeah, that's the question.
What we all have to do is what we practice inside those penitentiaries and get locked up in the hole for. We have to get a grip on ourselves, and we have to relate to one another. So we can no longer afford to pass each other in the street and not and shine each other on, not greet each other. We can no longer afford to watch a child grow up next door to us and allow him to grow up without us being able to influence his life and get into his head and get into his heart and make him a friend, and make him a friend not only of his neighbor, but a friend of his family members and a friend of his entire community. We have to share with him the knowledge we have about the greatest people that ever come up in our existence, man, who put forth some kind of skillful effort that we are proud of and talk about in Black history. We got to quit talking about history and talk about today. And we have to make history today by getting a grip on ourselves. And if somebody gets so out of control, they wind up going to these penitentiaries, understand this, they're going to come back one day. Some of them is going to come back. Are they going to come back hostile? Are they going to come back to an element that rejects them? If so, then you're going to be in conflict with them. So we have to resolve the differences and the conflict among ourselves and practice the unity that we used to have. So it's time for us to reunite and to put unity in action.
Is there anything else that Najee or Shaka would like to add?
Yeah, well, you know, we didn't get a chance to go all into the effort that's taking place now to heighten this issue of political prisoners and state repression on an international level. It's a working group within the U.S. Human Rights Network that's taking the lead on that and engaging the United Nations Human Rights Council within the Universal Periodic Review in November. The United States is going up for review in order to be evaluated and scrutinized on their adherence to human rights laws and international law. You can get more information on that. You can read the reports if you go to ushrnetwork.org. And on August 31st, there's going to be a special Black August commemorative educational call. People can call in. Kumasi is going to be one of the presenters talking about the history of Black August, and also we'll be talking about the how this process is going to work, and you can get more info on that. You go on Facebook to the Black August Planet Organization group page, all the info's there, or you can email us at bapo.network@gmail.com, and I can send you the information.
All right, Shaka?
Yes, just for all those people that this will go out to, this is, what's been said on the air this morning is the reason we call for Black August resistance to spread around the world. So people to disassociate themselves from the madness that they know they can't, okay, from the distractions. And if they only do it for this 1 month, that's a beginning. Okay, and that instills in their nature, in the nature of their children, and it influences their community to do those things that uplift us. And that's why we call for Black August Resistance. So we just ask people to, if they can just do it for this month, that's the beginning, Black August Resistance.
Well, let me say that September the 5th, I'll be on again. And I would like to invite you brothers back on if you have the time to, we can continue this discussion in September, because I think Attica took place in September. Something is, Steve Biko got killed in September, and is there anything around Comrade George Jackson that took place in September?
No.
It don't matter. We can.
The Attica. I think you mentioned the Attica Rebellion.
Yes, sir.
And from my understanding, the assassination of George Jackson was sparked
that.
It sparked that. Like, of course, there were already conditions in the prison that laid the groundwork for it, but the assassination of George Jackson was like the spark, the straw that broke the camel's back, you know, in that particular issue. So George Jackson is directly related to the Attica uprising.
All right, so will you buy this and Kumasi's Folsom Manifesto was made.
The Folsom Manifesto, yeah, I'm looking at the Folsom Manifesto right now. It's in a book, Angela Davis, If They Come in the Morning. I would like to know, so you brothers would accept that invitation, I hope.
Oh, yeah.
All right,
you got our commitment on it.
All right, sir, I hate to, time is a hell of a thing, but we'll speak to everyone next in September.
All right.
Okay. Look forward to it, man, and thank you. Thank you for this opportunity today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, and anytime, yeah, I'm trying to be an ox for the people to ride.
Well, you're working.
Okay.
You're working it.
All right, sir. Take care. All right, Uhuru.
Peace.
And you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. This is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond. We're getting ready to start the second part of our show, and we wanted to let you know that we have, if you want to send us an email, you can go to dj@uhururadio.com, or you can Skype us at skypeuhuru.com, and if you have, if you want to call us, you can call in North America, 727-585-1599. North America is supposedly Mexico. I don't know if you can call that number from Mexico, but definitely Canada and the United States. You can call 727-585-1599, or if you're in the UK, 020-813-3666-29. And we're going to start the second portion of Saturday Morning Live. We're going to go to Trinidad and Tobago. We're going to play a man by the name of Slinger Francisco, a.k.a. the Mighty Sparrow, born in Grenada, and he's going to talk about something that this, the thing about many of the political prisoners, one of the reasons why a lot of the political prisoners are still political prisoners, because they obviously are opposed to racism, but they are opponents of capitalism and imperialism. When you take a position against capitalism, you're looking at jail, death, exile, or all the above. So we're going to play something called Capitalism Gone Mad by the Mighty Sparrow.
Some kind of petty bourgeoisie. Anytime you're living here
in this country,
you gotta be in skullduggery, making your money illicitly to live like somebody
in this country.
It's outrageous and insane.
Them crazy prices they had the people pay,
and like the merchants gone clean out their brain. Lord, the work
he's simply toiling in vain.
Where you ever hear a television?
It's 20,000
only millions when you're talking land. Hundreds of dollars for a stinking pair of sneakers, half a million for a cheap motor car. It hurt here in Trinidad. Put a hand, Lord, capitalism. Capitalism gone mad. Advantage, suffrage, they're too greedy.
Capitalism
salary is an impossibility in this country. With so many bills to pay, there is no conceivable way to save for a rainy day. In this country, avariciousness, to be precise, is why every damn thing so overpriced. Businessman making everybody feel, government give them a open license to steal. If you think I lie, one nylon panty
is $19.90.
$20 for some baby milk. A wrong neck jersey
is $260.
$300 and change a yard for silk. It hard, Lord, I feel inside. Oh Lord, capitalism.
Capitalism gone mad.
Is bribery, skullduggery, conspiracy. To buy a pack of cigarettes does leave you with a hole in your wallet and money so hard to get.
In this country,
necessities or luxuries, it doesn't matter what the item is, they're charging anything they please.
In this country,
primary school books, prices lewd,
is highway robbery, the price of food.
All politician
expecting good work at each
other. How the stupid, so the cheapest coffee
is 20,000.
Not even dying to daisy. Thousands of dollars
for them thieving undertakers.
So you could bribe your way into the cemetery.
It's sad and looks so macabre.
Lord have mercy,
capitalism. Capitalism gone mad.
You gotta have heavy contact, know how to move up in society to make any kind of impact.
In this country,
you gotta know how to chip the field, how to scheme and swindle properly, perfect the art of wheel and deal.
In this country,
because survival in this land
is not so easy.
With unemployment and high inflation, somehow we go dead
before the end of this recession.
Would you believe me, one mango Julie for
$11.50,
$40 for watermelon, half your salary
to buy fish, get milk and poultry,
time you buy greens or
capitalism gone mad.
do I say goodbye to what we had? The good times that made us laugh outweigh the bad. I thought we'd get so hard to say goodbye to yesterday. I don't know where this road is gonna lead. What we've been through, if it gets me to tomorrow, I hope it's worth all the pain. It's so hard to say goodbye to yesterday.
Uhuru, this is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, and you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We were listening to the music of the Mighty Sparrow, Capitalism Gone Mad, and it has gone mad in the United States, it's gone mad in Europe, and it's always been mad in Africa, and capitalism is probably the reason why, not probably, but it is the reason why there's so much misery in Africa, Asia, Latin America. Part of the problem with this Pakistan situation is a lot of it has to do with the social system, but we'll deal with that later. This is Diasporic Music. My name is Norman Richmond, and we were listening to The Mighty Sparrow, Capitalism Gone Mad, and we also heard it from a young man by the name of G.C. Cameron, and G.C. Cameron hails from Mississippi, and he grew up in Mississippi and in Detroit, Michigan, and he was the lead singer of the Spinners. He came into the Spinners after he came back from Vietnam, and he auditioned for Harvey Fuqua, the lead singer of the Moonglows, and Harvey, he auditioned for Marvin Gaye and Harvey Fuqua, and of course he got the job, and he became the lead singer of the Spinners. And then Motown had big ideas for him, and he left the Spinners. He left the Spinners, and he did the soundtrack for the film Coolie Eye. And we were listening to How Do I Say Goodbye to Yesterday. That's the original version. And a little bit later on, he became Temptation. He sang with the Temptations, and the Temptations won a Grammy with the GC as their lead singer. And he also did an album with Sarita Wright Muhammad, Stevie Wonder's former wife, Sarita, And he also recorded a song called It's a Shame, which was written by Syreeta, Stevie Wonder, and Stevie Wonder played drums on that particular track. But right now we're going to listen to a song that was written by Stevie Wonder for his wife at the time, Syreeta Wright, and she is joined by the great G.C. Cameron.
Shame the way you mess around with the man. It's a shame the way you hurt me. It's a shame the way you mess around with your man. I'm sitting all alone by the telephone waiting for your call. When you don't call at all, it's a shame the way you mess around with your man. It's a shame the way you play with my emotion. It's a shame the way you mess around with your man. You're like a child at play on a sunny day. First you play with her, and then you throw it away.
Why do you use me? Try to confuse me. How can you stand to be so cruel? Why don't you free me from this prison? For serve my time as a fool.
It's a shame the way you mess around with the man. It's a shame. Speak with you, show your love so true, but you won't appreciate the love we try to make. Oh, it's a, got to be a shame.
Why do you use me? Why to confuse me? How can you stand to be so cruel? Why don't you leave?
And this is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalawi. We were listening to the music of G.C. Cameron out front. He was also joined by Bobby Smith, Henry Frambrone. They're still in the land of the living. They are still with the Spinners. The late Bobby Smith, not Bobby Smith, but the late Billy Henderson, and Purvis Jackson, they are no longer in the land of the living. And the Spinners have a new group, and but that was the Spinners in in the late 60s, early 70s. And after that, G.C. left the Spinners, and he was replaced by Felipe Wynn, Phil Soul Walker. And Phil Soul Walker was also used to perform with Bootsy Collins, and they're out of Cincinnati, Ohio. And I should mention that Bootsy Collins' brother, Catfish Collins, passed away recently, a great guitarist who played with Bootsy's Rubber Band and also with James Brown along with Bootsy. And also another bass player, we lost another bass player, Robert Wilson, one of the Gap Band out of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Robert Wilson was only 53 years old, but what's that song they did? The Oops Upside Your Head. It said Oops Upside Your Head and Burn Rubber on Me. Robert Wilson was a great, great, great bass player, and he's the brother of Charlie Wilson. Charlie, Burn Rubber on Me, and I'm a big, huge Charlie Wilson fan, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. And I would like to talk about some of the shows we have on Uhuru Radio. You know, you can get up in the morning and you can listen to Omali Ishatella Speaks. You can also listen to Africa Live with Naibinga Zimbabwe, the young man who is on the buttons for this particular show. You can listen to Penny Hess with Solidarity, Not Charity.
Then you can hear Yours Truly. Then you can hear The Church and a Revolution with Deacon Christopher Frazier. There is a new show on that's in Lingala. That's the language of many parts of the Congo. I don't know if they speak Lingala in other parts of other African states, but Lingala, I believe, was the language that Patrice Lumumba spoke. But there's a Lingala show which comes on. There's been one episode. It comes. It's recorded in Germany. We also have Uhuru on the Move with Shimarenga Waller and Kobina. They're doing that particular show, and we also have a French show with Omali Ishatella, which the host is Louise Kinshasa, and we have Rob Bob Simple, Caribbean Forum, a very important show, and like he says, he tells me to strike up the band, so I guess I have to strike up the band right now before we speak with Kilo and Yasha. We're not going to strike up the band. We're going to do a little 50-part harmony with a group out of this is a group of sisters that I know. Bernice Reagan is based in Bernice Johnson Reagan, or Reagan Johnson. Sister Bernice is with a founder of Sweet Honey and the Rock, a great a cappella group. There's also a group in Canada out of Nova Scotia called For the Moment, which were inspired by Sweet Honey and the Rock. But this is one of my favorite groups, and this is a song, a proletariat song. This is for the working class, the African working class, and the working class period. And like I said in the last show I did, one of the first things that Marcus Garvey did when he came to the United States was to go into a coal mine in Pittsburgh to see the conditions that African workers were laboring under in the United States. And this song by Sweet Honey and the Rock captures all the agony that working people, especially African working people, have to go through. And this is Sweet Honey and the Rock, and it's called More Than a Paycheck.
We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. I say we bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families.
I wanted more today, but what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that door, I bring home asbestosis and silicosis, prolonged long black lung disease, and the radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived.
We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families.
I wanted more than a paycheck, but what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that door, I bring home
asbestosis and silicosis from round long black lung disease, and the radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived.
We bring more
than just a little paycheck.
You're
bringing more than a paycheck. I'm bringing more. You're bringing more than just a little paycheck.
Well, now workers lending here, Cause it's important that you know that whatever we job there is the fear that disease will take its toll. If not disease, then injury. My Lord, maybe fall or not. And if not injury, then stress is going to tie you up in knots. And so we take home more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family. Bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family. Bring asbestosis and silicosis around long black lung disease. And the radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived. More than just a little bit of
And this is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. And we were listening to the music of Sweet Honey and the Rock, a song about more than a paycheck, about those coal mines. And we're getting ready to do our last half an hour where we have Kilo and Yasha, who's going to run the last leg of this relay. She is the anchor woman. And Kilo and Yasha is based in San Francisco, former member of the Black Panther Party. She is a journalist, and she knew Comrade George Jackson personally. And we're going to be speaking with Kilo about Comrade George Jackson and other areas. Kilo, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you so much for having me on the show, Norman.
I wanted to know, is there anything you wanted to add about yourself that I didn't mention, because I know you're involved in a lot of things and how people can get a hold of you before...
Well, I've been struggling to get political prisoners out of jail since 1969. How's that?
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, we have had some successes, but we've had many, many failures. I'm advocating strongly right now amnesty for all prisoners, particularly political prisoners and prisoners of war who have served 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's enough. It's a nice round figure, and it will catch up nearly all of our Panther and Young Lord and Patriot Party and Peace and Freedom Party and Communist Party and every other individual protester and dissenter and resistor that is still locked up after 25 years. We have Sundiata Okoli, who is in jail now, 36, was just denied 10. We have Hugo Pinel, one of the last of the San Quentin Six, who were charged in the aftermath of the assassination of George Jackson and Five Pigs. And he is doing his 46th year, Rochelle McGee, his 47th year. I got a letter just recently, an OG who was with George in the Adjustment Center at San Quentin, one of the 26 prisoners, 27 with George, who were in the AC that day, Arthur Anderson, we call him Fray Limo, got in touch with me through the Bayview, and he just did 47 and got denied 3 more. So that said, we really have to mount a campaign. We can't let more of our political prisoners die in prison. We've already lost several. You know, Noah Washington comes to mind immediately. We lost him in 2000 to cancer. Marilyn Buck just got out, and 3 weeks later she was gone after doing
Could we talk about George right now, and we can get back into that?
Okay, I'm sorry. I got carried away.
No.
Forgive me.
Well, I know that's I know you've been on this case for so long. You definitely want to get to, and you want to see justice for everyone.
Yes, I
do.
Comrade George, you knew George Jackson personally, and I wanted to know, how did you meet George, and what were your thoughts the first time you saw George Jackson?
Oops. Oh, that's a great question. Well, I was in New Haven, and he was in San Quentin in California. I was working for Charles Gary and on the Seal Huggins trial in New Haven, Connecticut, and I read Soledad Brother, The Prison Letters of George Jackson. That's how I met George Jackson, through the pages of his first book, which was a bestseller at the time. We're talking early 1971, winter 1971. So I asked Charles Gary if I could get a letter. I had some questions, some comments, some kudos, and I wanted to see if I knew that Charles knew Faye Stender, who was his attorney at the time, had been his attorney, but by the time we wrote, when he wrote me back, it was John Thorne who had taken up his case. But in any case, Charles did get the letter through, and I remember writing him a two-page typewritten letter. And there were no computers at that time, no laptops. So he wrote me back on yellow legal paper in pencil, a two- or three-page long letter answering all my questions, and I was just blown away because, you know, when you write to somebody who's a celebrity, you don't really expect to get an answer. You just hope for one. And he was so responsive, and that initiated a correspondence. And I had planned to, he invited me to come out here, I'm in California now, to work on his defense. He was on trial, he was going through the pretrial hearings of the Soledad Brothers case. And so I had, I declined his offer because I was coming anyway, and I could stay at my mother's house that my stepfather was living in at the time, and I didn't have to worry about a place to stay, et cetera. So I did come out here. He told me to get a press card so that I could visit him. His visiting list was full. So I did. I went to Charles Gary, who went called Goodlett. Publisher of the Sun Reporter. I wound up with a job I wasn't looking for, but it was an opportunity to cover the pretrial hearings of the Soledad brothers and Angela and Rochelle, Angela Davis and Rochelle McGee, who were also going through their pretrial hearings in the wake of the August 7th rebellion. So I did get in to see George for 1 hour about a month in July of 1971, a contact visit in the holding cell at San Quentin. So we were able to sit there puffing smoke in each other's face. We both were chain smokers at the time. And we had a conversation about what was going on. And the first time I saw him, let me back up just a little bit. The first time I saw him was in court. And I had gone to court, and we saw each other for the first time. And we were both smitten. Because at that time, I really, if you look at the cover, the old cover of the Soledad Brother, you know, he has horn-rimmed glasses on. He was an intellectual, and I was like 32 years old at the time, and 31 or 32, and I really didn't think that he would be physically together because, you know, my experience to date had been those who had their mental, who were intellectuals, usually didn't do too much physically and weren't too in such great shape, and the opposite held true of the ones who were athletic. They often didn't have any intellect to speak of, didn't do much studying. So I was shocked when I saw him because, you know, I had thought he was exaggerating when he said he could do 1,000 fingertip push-ups a day, but he was really all that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I remember you talked about George, the intellectual George Jackson. When he passed away, he had 99 books in his cell, and the fact that he sort of pushed you politically to read and to study.
Oh, yes. He encouraged everyone to study and read, and that was his impact on the prisoners around him. You know, he was transforming the gangster mentality into a revolutionary mentality, and they were studying and reading Fanon and Marx and Lenin and Mao and Engels and, you know, Che and they were developing a revolutionary ideology, and George was definitely the ideologue. I mean, he was the one who was the leader in terms of the ideas and the strategies and tactics. He was just an amazing guy. I mean, he also studied martial arts. And on his death, I would just resolve that I was going to be George. But, I tried too hard to be a martial artist and wound up, you know, with many inflamed muscles. But and that's another story. But and intellectually, I feel like I'm still growing. And that's the whole idea that George and Yogi still perpetuates is the idea of becoming the new man, the new woman. And growing, constantly growing, physically, mentally, emotionally growing. And some of us have crashed, as Yogi put it in a letter recently. Some folks, he named some names, but I won't name them here.
When you talk about Yogi, could you talk about Hugo Pinnell? Could you give us, just give us
yes.
He's an African, he is.
Well, we're all Africans. He's from Nicaragua. A Latino brother who identified with blacks at a time when that was very dangerous because,
right.
And it's still somewhat dangerous because they have the prison population in California particularly segregated, Mexicans and Latinos, blacks and whites, and they're the Aryan Brotherhood and the Nazis and all those who are still existent. But at that time, it was even more pronounced and more deadly.
Right.
So the brothers, Hugo Pinnell, they called him the general. He a book that could teach folks a lot about that period of time is Min Yi's The Melancholy History of Soledad Prison. And it's an excellent one, and it talks about Yogi there, but... Yogi and George were tight. W.L. Nolan, Bill Christmas, James McLean, and others. Howard Toll. They were the brothers who formed the nucleus of the Black Movement. And later, some of them morphed into the Black Panther Party behind the walls. And George Jackson became its field lieutenant. Hugo Pinnell was with George in the AC, and he was one of the six who caught the case. The longest trial in California history, this case of the San Quentin Six. And I will never forget the sight of these brothers wearing 30 pounds of chains shuffling into the courtroom, all fine, all upstanding, beautiful brothers. And all of them got out except Hugo Pinnell, who's locked down now 46 years. Most of them in solitary, and he's in that monster shoe in Pelican Bay to this day, 20 years there now.
Let me say that you're listening to Uhuru Radio. This is Diasporic Music. I'm on the line with Kilu and Yasha, who's based in San Francisco. And I wanted to ask you, we're going to take a musical break in a few moments, but I wanted to ask you about George Jackson and languages. I remember reading Malcolm X, and Malcolm talked about wanting to study Chinese because Chinese would be the political language, Arabic would be the spiritual language, and of course Malcolm wanted to learn many, many African languages. But George basically took that same position in terms of learning languages. Do you remember having any conversations with George?
No, I don't remember. The only thing I remember about languages was his telling me that the book had been translated into, I think, at least three, possibly more, languages. Soledad Brother.
I think Soledad Brother has been. I might be getting mixed up with the autobiography of Malcolm X, but I think Soledad Brother was published in French, Spanish, Farsi, which is.
I know it was published in French, and I'm pretty sure Spanish. I just don't remember the other languages. Possibly Italian.
Now we're going to take a music break, and this was a story that a young man told me, and there was a young man by the name of Frank Morgan who played alto saxophone,
who was from Los Angeles, California, and he was in the tradition of Charlie Yardbird Parker, alto player, who was sent to prison, and he was in prison with George Jackson. I believe it was in San Quentin, and Frank Morgan had did something wrong, and these prisoners wanted to do something to him because he had did something that he shouldn't have done. And George sent word out that, you know, leave the comrade alone, because anybody that plays alto that pretty, you know, it would be a crime. It would be a crime to touch this man, so just leave him alone, you know. So we're going to listen to Frank Morgan and come back, and I'll be speaking with Kilu and Yasha on Uhuru Radio. Thank you.
And you're listening to Uhuru Radio. This is Diasporic Music. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. I'm on the line with Kilu Inyasha, who is based in San Francisco. And Kilu, I wanted to ask you two questions. One, I wanted to get your position, not your position, but I wanted to get you to give all your information out on how people can contact you and the blogs and the MySpaces and all that kind of stuff you have. One.
Right on.
And secondly, I wanted to ask you, could you talk about George Jackson's position on women in particular and the position of men in this period in general in terms of the woman question? How are we males doing when it comes to our practice on women? Dealing with women, pardon me.
That's a loaded question, but I'll answer the first one first.
Yes, ma'am.
You can go to my blog spot by just writing out my name, Kilu Inyasha, K-I-I-L-U-N-Y-A-S-H-A .blogspot.com. And then you can link to MySpace, and you can link to YouTube, and you can find my email address, kilu2@sbcglobal.net. And if you look, check your information, you can even call me because I'm listed.
Okay.
I'm very accessible to the people since I know the pigs already got their fingers on me.
All right. In terms of George Jackson and the question of women, how did you feel that George did? How did you think George's position? How was George's position on women?
Okay, well, I don't think George was a rare exception. I think he was somewhat exceptional in that he did believe that a woman should be side by side in struggle in the war with the brothers. So in that sense, he was progressive. But I don't believe that too many men, just like there aren't too many whites who have managed to overcome their chauvinism. In the case of whites, it's their anti-black, anti-people of color chauvinism, which we call racism. And in the case of men, it's their anti-feminine brainwashing, their male superiority complexes, and feeling that men have to always be in the driver's seat, that women are subordinate, et cetera, et cetera.
Hello. Hello, you're listening to Uhuru Radio. Have we lost Kilu?
Yes.
Boy, I guess that was so hot. The phone went out. We can call her back again. You're listening to Uhuru Radio. This is Diasporic Music, and we're going to try to get Kilu Inyasha, or we're going to get Kilu Inyasha back on the air. Are you going to a musical break? You're listening to Uhuru Radio. This is Diasporic Music, and we are speaking with Kilu Onyasha, and she was burning up the phone line so much that we lost her. It was so hot. But continue, my sister.
Yes. So I was talking about racism, and I would just like to briefly say that I look at it as sort of on a scale of 1 to 10. Racism so permeates the fabric of our societies, universally, really, and color chauvinism and all that crap. White supremacy is here. So we're all, and it's institutionalized. So on a scale of 1 to 10, I deal with people, if they're past 5, okay, past 5, I can't deal with you. That's too much chauvinism for me, too much racism, too much superiority coming at me, okay? But between 1 and 5, I think we're all somewhere in there. I like to think I'm maybe a 2 or maybe not even that much. I'm struggling very hard to overcome all the last vestiges of that, you know, inability to accept every person and give him or her the benefit of the doubt. I feel like we should not judge a book by its cover, and I struggle with that, and that's part of becoming the new man, the new woman. And the same holds true with men. Men cannot say, I'm not chauvinist. I laughed when George said that, because of course they're chauvinists. They're privileged. Men are privileged from Jump Street in all societies throughout this world, and some much worse than others. I mean, the infanticide of girls is a known fact. Boys are prized. And that's why, I mean, as a child, I was labeled a tomboy, for being athletic. Thank goodness that women have achieved, made enormous strides in sports. But we're still not given the due. And in leadership, I think that the reason our movements are flailing all over the world is because women should be leading the movements. Women are much better able to be diplomats, to solve problems nonviolently. They are much more caring of children and life. I think that if we had and I'm not talking about being as fascist as the men, like Hillary Clinton, you know, and what Angela Merkel. No, I'm not talking about becoming a better fascist than the male fascist.
You're not talking about putting men completely out of leadership, are you?
I beg your pardon?
I say you're not talking about completely putting men out of leadership, are you?
Oh, no, of course not. I think there should be equality. However, if women prove to be the more capable leaders, then they should be elevated to the leadership position without any hesitation. However, if a male better qualifies in a given circumstance than the women to be the leader in that given situation, then that person should be the leader. However, I'm not too into the leader. I think that we should need collective leadership.
Collective leadership, yeah.
And I think that there should be a rotating chairman, okay, because we get too into hierarchical situations, and we develop our own hierarchies and our own personality cults that have often defeated us.
You're listening to Uhuru Radio, Diasporic Music. My name is Norman Otis Richmond. I think we have about 2 minutes left, Kilu and Yasha, and I think we're going to have to bring this conversation to a close, and I think you've opened up something that we can all talk about. And I would just like to say that I was reading a book about Malcolm X and Martin, and by James Cone, one of the liberation theologists, and he made the point that Malcolm and Dr. King had male chauvinistic tendencies. He was saying that, and he took a lot of heat for that. But I think that's something that we men are going to have to face, the fact that we are privileged when it comes to society, you know, in all societies, not just I mean, I think that everybody wants to put down the Muslim countries, but the capitalist countries, the imperialist countries that we live in, have some issues to deal with as well.
Exactly.
When it comes to the issue, when it comes to the gender question, right?
Can I leave you with just one